The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts. The temple is an affiliate of Boundless Way Zen, a multi-lineage school of Zen Buddhism.
Some of you may have noticed the snow just starting to fall around the time we were finishing breakfast. And every time a snowfall begins, even a light one like this one, it takes me back to the huge excitement I felt as a kid in Seattle when we would see it snowing, because it didn't snow that much in Seattle thanks to the Japan current. It's very temperate there. And our sleds would stay up in the garage attic for 2 or 3 years at a time until we could finally use them. So we would see these snowflakes coming down and say, "It's snowing!" Even if you were in school, you would do that. And, of course, I wanted to do that when I saw them a while ago, but I knew I'd have to wait until now. So, in honor of the snow, I'm going to read you a koan about snow. And the title of this koan is Layman Pang's Beautiful Snow. Layman Pang was leaving Yaoshan's temple. Yaoshan ordered 10 of his monks to see him off at the gate. Layman Pang pointed to the snow falling through the air and said, "Beautiful snowflakes. They don't fall in that other place." One of the monks, whose name was Chuan, asked, "Where do they fall?" Pang gave him a slap. Chuan said, "Don't be so hasty, Pang." Pang said, "If you speak of yourself as a Chan monk in such poor condition, the king of death will never release you." "What about you, Pang?" asked Chuan. Pang slapped him again and said, "You see with your eyes, but you are just like someone who's blind. You speak with your mouth, but you are just like someone who's dumb." So, I love this koan. And let's just start with the fact that there's someone in it named Layman Pang. And that tells us two things. One thing it tells us is that there's always been a place for lay practitioners and even for important lay teachers in Zen, all the way back to ancient China. When Zen was called Chan. And at least from the second generation of Chan teachers, in the same generation as Wei Kei, Bodhidharma's heir, was Mahasattva Fu, who was a lay teacher. And the most famous of all these lay practitioners who were known for their deep realization was Layman Pang. Now, the second thing that we're told by the fact that he's called Layman Pang is that there weren't that many lay teachers like this. There weren't that many lay people with such deep realization, or he wouldn't have been called Layman. And most of the teachers we hear about and most of the teachers that appear in our koan collections are indeed ordained priests. And the lay ancestors don't come up that much in things like ancestor dedication, such as the one we just did, because transmission has the lineage transmission has always gone through ordained priests, and yet they're there, and they are important to us who are practicing together at a time when most Zen practitioners are in fact laypersons, are in fact lay practitioners, and I'm quite conscious of the fact that there's still a little, you know, question about what it means to be a lay practitioner with any kind of teaching claim as I sit here surrounded by priests to the left of me, priests to the right of me. And so I take heart from these ancestors that whose names have survived and whose stories have survived. And there are lots of stories about Layman Pang, who had a day job. He made baskets and bamboo utensils, who had a family, and so stands as an exemplar for those of us who are trying to live a lay life and at the same time devote ourselves fully to the Dharma. I love the way that this particular koan begins. Let's kind of go through it together. So he's leaving Yaoshan's temple. He's been visiting the temple. And the abbot of the temple, Yaoshan, clearly recognizes Peng as a notable practitioner and a person deserving of respect, because he sends him off with 10 monks as a kind of honor guard to see him to the gate, a little retinue. This would be a high honor for any teacher, let alone a lay teacher. And I'm not sure that the 10 monks all appreciated this, one of them seems a little annoyed at having to do this. It must have been very, very odd to them that a layman would come out with this sort of treatment. And as they get outside, just as now it's lightly snowing, and Layman Peng pointed to the snow and said, "Beautiful snowflakes." So I want to stop there for a moment. If you're in ancient China, in pre-modern China, and you're about to take a journey at a time when the roads are really bad and there aren't modern maps, you know, I'm not sure that everybody would be so pleased to see it starting to snow. He might well have said, "Oh, shit," or something like that. But he is not seeing the snowflakes from the standpoint of his personal preferences, whether he would worry about this making his journey much harder or even fatal or not. He sees them from a very different perspective. Beautiful snowflakes. And I think the best gloss on the way he's seeing them was in one of the readings we did today. All dharmas are innately amazing beyond description, right? Or another way to put that might be beautiful snowflakes. And I think if the koan stopped there, it would still be a wonderful koan. Still be a great story. Beautiful snowflakes, the monks bowed. Now it's over. But that's not what happens. It probably wouldn't be in the Blue Cliff record if it had ended there. And this is case number 42 in that great collection. Beautiful snowflakes. He adds this interesting teaching for the monks, because I believe that this is what he's doing. They don't fall in that other place. Now, I have to tell you, the commentators are all over the map on this. Even though I think it's pretty clear that this is the core of the koan. They don't fall in that other place. And sometimes it's translated, "They don't fall elsewhere." And sometimes it's translated even this way, "Each one falls in its own place." And these represent very different ways of turning this phrase and thinking about it. And I will not examine all of them. But I want to start with that last one, that taking "they don't fall elsewhere" as meaning each one falls in its own place. Because I find that very attractive at the moment. So each snowflake falls in its own place. And I've been watching the snow and sort of sitting with this, or walking with it, or being with it. And I'm wondering if in this way of reading the koan, there's a recognition that, as we know now, every snowflake is unique. Each one is a slightly different form. And each one has its own pattern of falling, which is totally unpredictable. Mike talked last night about all the causes and conditions that we include in this term karma, and the karma of snowflakes, right? Quite complex. Lots of causes and conditions have to exist even for there to be snow. Different temperatures in the stratosphere and the lower atmosphere and the ground temperature and the right amount of humidity and then we can add things like gravitational force and wind speed and all of these factors. making each snowflake fall in just its own place. They don't fall elsewhere. Why do they fall in this place? Because it's the only place they could have fallen. Given that dense network, that miraculous web of causes and conditions. And yet, when they fall, when they're on the ground, they become part of an undifferentiated mass that we call snow. And I don't think that there is anybody, or that there ever has been anybody, who can reach their hand down into the snow and pull out one snowflake. And so I find in this a kind of wonderful example of form and emptiness, which we were chanting about when we did the Heart Sutra. Here come all these beautiful, distinct forms, each taking its own slightly different path, each falling in its own place, and yet each becoming or manifesting its nature as an indistinguishable part of the whole. And this is us. This is our lives. Each one of us, you know, all these distinctions we make. I talked about the lay priest distinction. We could talk about male-female distinctions. We could talk about human distinctions all day. And yet, and so each one of us distinct like these snowflakes. And yet each one of us falling in this place. Here we are, a sangha, one heart, practicing together. And I think that part of the teaching that Layman Pang's giving to the monks is that the monks are like this. Here are these 10 monks. And I think from a distance, you know, they must look a little bit like the negative images of snowflakes. Each one slightly different, but all of them in black robes, all of them with shaved heads, all of them trying to do their best to have a Chan expression, a Zen expression, all of them in their straw sandals. No wonder they're a little annoyed to be out there in the snow saying farewell to Layman Pang, this lay guy. And yet, so each in their own place, and yet each of them part of a sangha, as we are today. But that's not the way that at least one of the monks takes it. One of the monks decides that maybe Layman Pang doesn't really deserve this honor, and so he takes the statement as an invitation for a little dharma combat. He's going to assert himself, and maybe a little cheekily. So the monk whose name was Chuan asked, "Where do they fall?" Not a bad question, really. Where do they fall? And yet, clearly from Layman Pang's standpoint, not even remotely to the point. And so, how does Pang answer? Pang gave him a slap. Ow! So, Layman Pang, one of his teachers was the great Chan teacher Ma Zhu. And Ma Zhu, Layman Pang was in the 8th century. And the generation before Pang included Ma Zhu. And Ma Zhu was credited, or has been credited sometimes, with having initiated the blows and shouts style of Zen that has lasted, you know, that lasted well through Japanese and Korean Zen, and not used so much, as we keep reminding you, in American Zen. And yet we can see where it comes from. This slap, not a slap out of anger, not a slap meant to hurt, but a slap out of compassion, trying to slap Chuan awake. Wake up! Wake up! Beautiful snowflakes. Chuan, each one falls in its own place. Wake up! Wake up! And Chuan doesn't take it that way. He stands his ground. Not always a good idea to stand your ground in a koan. Chuan said, "Don't be so hasty, Pang. In some versions of this story, and there are various versions that are that have slight differences, Chuan says, that is coarse even for a layman. So don't be so hasty, Peng. And so another teaching moment, as far as Peng is concerned. If you speak of yourself as a Chan monk in such poor condition, the king of death will never release you. You will be forever bound in this cycle of birth and death. Not something that's happening over our biological lifetimes, in Chan and Zen at least, but something that's happening from moment to moment, this moment to moment reconsolidation of the self, of the ego, which is constantly dissolving because it's purely illusory. And so it has to get knitted back together. And how do we knit it to get back together? We knit it back together in moments like, don't be so hasty, Peng. What do you mean slapping me? That's coarse even for a layman. This self-assertion. This self-assertion is also self-creation. It's self-maintenance. It's terrifying to feel the self dissolving sometimes. Big task we're asking of ourselves here, to let the self fall apart, to just let it go. And Chuan, I think, according to Peng, and I agree with him, isn't letting it happen. The king of death will never release you. And Chuan, one more time, boy, this kid is one stubborn. By the way, I talked the other day about how I imagine monks usually as the age of my college students. I think these ones are more like high school students. You know, really, because a lot of monks started at 15, 16, 17. I see Chuan as maybe the tall 18-year-old among these adolescents. What about you, Peng? Peng slapped him again and said, you see with your eyes, but you're just like someone who's blind. You speak with your mouth, but you're just like someone who's dumb. Some commentators feel there's a bit too much slapping in this koan. I don't know. Some others might feel that Chuan is eminently slappable. I'll leave that with you to decide. Now, there's one little part of the koan. The koan has a kind of little tale that I didn't read to you before. T-A-I-O. And this is a comment by another great Chan teacher, Xue Dou, who was the first editor of the Blue Cliff Record. And some of the koans include his comments, and his comments are always wonderful. And here's Xue Dou's comment, which is given in parentheses, Xue Dou, so that we know that Xue Dou wasn't there. This was centuries later. Xue Dou. At the first words, that would be beautiful snowflakes. At the first words, I would have just hit him with a snowball. How glad he would have been. And I will let Xue Dou have the last word. So we will move into Dharma dialogue, and please feel free to sit comfortably. And as you know, the talk is being recorded, and you are free to ask at any moment that the recording be paused, especially if you want to say something like, that's coarse even for a layperson.
I always have a hard time with that claim that no two snowflakes are alike. Mm. That I know it's statistical, but it's much more certain that no one could ever know that. But I can believe that no two paths of snowflakes are alike, and that's easy to believe, although it's as uncheckable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, how could you know that no two snowflakes were alike? How could you know that no two grains of sand were alike?
Right. That's what I'm saying.
Well, I'm asking you how. I'm not saying how could you, I'm saying how could you.
Okay. Well, but the thing is, I think you're pointing to something so important, Jenny, right? this deep appreciation we have of not knowing. It's impossible to know anything. Well, we think we do. You know, we come up with theories and statistics and all this kind of crap. But really, if you're honest, and I feel like you're being honest, how can you possibly? So thanks for injecting that.
And when we were, you said it's always a bad idea to stand your ground in a koan.
No, I said sometimes.
I mean a koan.
just assume.
Okay. Okay.
Well, okay. And I think we could say it's always a good idea to stand your ground in a koan, right? That this is engaging, and some of us have the style of, well, the teacher's full of it, but I won't say anything. I'll just slink out, right? And when you push back, you will get something. And I think with life the same way. We can hide either way. Some of us hide by fighting all the time, and some of us hide by smiling and nodding. Right? Oh yeah, whatever you think. So I think the challenge for us all is, how do we engage as ourself and risk something? Sometimes it's a risk not to fight, right? And sometimes a risk to say, I don't understand what you just said. That doesn't make any sense to me, right? And either way, we get it. I mean, we get hit. And one of the things I wanted to say is that in 17th century China, there was a big doctrinal dispute about whether all of the slapping and hitting in the Tang Dynasty ever really happened. Because all of these things were written about 300 or 400 years after they supposedly happened. And there were two schools, and one played really rough and started hitting people. And that school actually didn't continue. So even in the 17th century, looking back, oh, did they really do that? But it is true that we do get hit by Zen teachers, by our life, by all kinds of things. We're going along fine, or we're pushing a little bit, and somebody says something that really gets us, you know, or it doesn't go the way we thought it would, or we get sick, you know. So we all get the wonderful slap of Layman Pong.
And I want to say a little more about this. It's such a great pointer, both pointers, I think, for you, Jenny. This thing about standing your ground. And I love what you just said, David. It doesn't make any difference whether you stand your ground or you don't stand your ground. You're going to find out something. Right? Life is going to teach you something. But in standing your ground or not standing your ground, we get to see the patterns that drive us unconsciously. And that's what David, I think, was pointing to. You know, maybe your pattern is to fight everything. Maybe your pattern is to just be a nice boy or girl. And they're both to see through them as they are fabrications of a self that ultimately will not last and not be dependable. And the other thing I want to say is that this there's no video evidence of the slapping and hitting. Right? There's no way to know that any... We could have just made up Zen 100 years ago. Nobody would know the difference, right? Because you have these people, historians, but most of the history has been disputed. So, when I first heard that, I thought, oh no! But then again, in the same way, I thought, oh, so what is be relied on then? Mm. The snowflakes in this mess. Yeah.
And if I could add...
we're all excited. You can
Just to relate to what you said, Melissa, yesterday, how can we enter this koan in seeing the slap as a compassionate act?
Right?
You know, this, what you just said, David, reality will always hit you when you respond. And so that act of slapping is probably the most compassionate thing Lin Peng could have done. Mm-hmm.
David, did you have a hand up?
Yeah. That particular thing is interesting. I wouldn't certainly advocate a return to corporeal and instruction. But I feel like maybe I'm wondering if we haven't, in the Ben Zen's come to West in the coattails of the late 60s, early 70s, and hippies, maybe gone to another extreme and is reticent to verbally slap sense into people and really a certain kind of real tough love.
You know, I think you're right here, David. In many ways, we actually, during our regular sesshin, not the coming and going sesshin, we do hit people. We have a kiyosaku, which translates as encouragement stick, a long stick. I'm looking around. Most of you have experienced it. And it's to, it's just, you know, to, hey, wake up. And you request it, because we have softened in that way. But I always remember my first teacher quoting some old, probably fictional, Tang Dynasty teacher who had gotten so old himself that he couldn't lift the stick anymore. So he would just pick up his slipper and hit people. And I feel like we as teachers do that, not physically, but you know, if you're acting like a jerk, we'll start by observing you, and then see if you're willing to be instructed. And if you are, then we will be pretty direct sometimes. But it's all permission. You know, you've decided, I am a person of the way. I want to engage in the teacher-student relationship. And still, it hurts and it's hard. Even just to be told, you know, to be given an instruction, right? So that's how we do it now. We've refined it. But I think the spirit of it, this is different than other forms of Buddhism. Zen teachers really do hit. And not everybody likes it. Yeah.
Griffin.
So the first thing you said in the beginning of your talk was about how, you know, when you were a little kid, you were just so excited about the snow. Mm-hmm. In the morning, the first thing you wanted to be like, whoopee, it's snowing. And it could be the exact same thing. And I'm actually kind of excited we have this little thing where I can say it too, because I have to wait till now. It's getting so,
yeah.
It was so beautiful. That's really happening. That's actually part of why I liked what Layman Peng was doing, because I feel like, I mean, to use a very much more modern sort of psychological thing, he's still got his inner child going on, and he's still loving that.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, you know, hey, look at the snow, it's so beautiful, this sort of childlike, innocent response. Mm-hmm. And so the kid's like, you know, oh, come on, you know, fuck the snow, isn't it? He's not around.
Right.
But, like, it's beautiful, that purity he's got going on, and I like that a lot.
Yeah, thank you, Griffin. And you know, when I hear inner child in that sense, I'm also thinking, you know, true nature. You know, that this is the part. Now, you know, having raised children, they're not always like this. but there's an aspect to childhood that really is radiant with everything that I personally think I mean when I say our original nature. And just that openness and that readiness to engage in whatever and that sheer delight at what's happening and ability to play for 3 hours with two pebbles and a stick, you know, and so I think that you've touched something that's both really important to this koan and also just really sweet. So, bowing to you.
I just wanted to say thank you. It was really a wonderful, wonderful talk. Really, thank you.
Will.
Can you say something about what you got from
this? I mean, so many virtues. I thought it was, you know, it's about the snow, which is still falling. It's not something you prepared weeks ago. Hopefully it's not.
True Zen powers.
It's not
attending. You know, it's about sort of basic, you know, very familiar experiences. You know, we know how it is as kids when it snows and how exciting that is. And I also thought, in a way, your gloss on the slaps was maybe the most direct way of, you know, people have said compassion and so on. but it's been left a little bit like, how is that compassionate? You have to work on it. You know, and I think you just glossed it in a way that made it very concrete. So I thought it was building very nicely on the other talks we've had. I love the learning behind it. I like that you know who their teachers were and traditions and are not afraid to sort of provide the footnotes. I really appreciate that.
So, Professor, do I get an A? We are both academics, so it's easy for us to go with a thank you.
I don't think that's the only reason I liked your talk.
Well, I want an A minus, so I have to keep trying hard.
You got it.
And thank you for responding that the way you did. Yes. But to hear, you know, oh, I liked your talk, but what? How did it hit you? How did it touch you? That's so valuable, because as you were talking, I said, yeah.
I think Esther had her hand up.
So I'm experiencing a different sense of the slap. And the words that slapped me or stirred me, shocked me or did something inside was around the really hard work that we, in a way, engage in as we allow the self to loosen, or as something is allowing the self to loosen. And earlier today I had a moment of slapping, and I noticed how to me it feels like these little moments of waking up to something. And I'm not sure it comes from the outside or from the inside, but something quickened inside. And so where the compassion for me comes in is when there's an impact and there is an effect. And then there is more and more in my life and in my experience, I feel a softening around the impact and an ability to hold myself in my humanness.
Yeah, thank you. When you said that, you know, you're not sure if it's something on the inside or something coming from outside, you know, what was coming up for me is how much I've learned about what I think of as my inside from these slaps that come from the outside, that those have been, you know, those have been great teachers for me. And I have discovered parts of myself that, honestly, I never wanted to know I had. And yet, you know, that's the only way to do this practice, is to do it with our whole selves, including the parts of us that we think that shouldn't be there. So thank you for your teaching, Esther.
And that moment you speak of, Esther, when we do, when something hits us, and I think we're cultivating the capacity to not run away from that. Because that moment something hits me, my first tendency is to cover it over. Well, nothing really happened, I'm fine. I'm cool, right? I'm Zen. But this vulnerability and the softening you speak of, I think is so such an encouragement, that when we're upset, when something hits us, if we can hang around there and be present in that situation, there's such an opportunity. But it takes such courage not to cover it over. Or, you know, some of us, I was talking before, some of us cover, I'm a cover over, you know. That's my strategy. Great strength I have, you know, but also great problem. Other people immediately attack. You said, I can't, you say that about me, and I'm going to, you know, and both of those are an avoidance. And this naming, whoa, something just hit me. But hanging out there. Then we meet something we have not encountered before.
Yeah, and my experience is also that the slap will come back if I try to cover up.
Yeah, right. Again.
Also, you know, move in the soft place and wanting to go toward being offensive and then just sort of retreating and so just observing these.
Yeah, right.
Where is it that we go when we're slapped?
Right. Yeah.
you know, your both your this dialogue is reminding me of our practice every day of Om Nam. Every single call to the universe has a response. Every single one, and whether it's a slap or what, and being open to that.
We have in common that years ago I used to teach mindfulness, and you were a student of me and my teaching partner, Florence. And Florence wrote the teaching down to one word, I don't know if you remember, step. Right. So I still think stay. She would gesture her hand for it. Stay. Stay. Whatever's arising. Stay with the reactivity. Whatever shape it's in. Thank you for doing that.
Right. I liked the koan very much. I see the... I am the 18-year-old, and will be, I think, all my life. and clearly, so yes, Pong says something beautiful, and I'm in a bad mood, and I don't particularly like it. I'm suffering. What's going on? And I put it out there in my habitual way, right? That you know, whatever, criticizing or judging or whatever, however form it takes, it's out there. And so I don't see the slap as so much a slap, but something that happens that releases this story about that I've fabricated about who I am and what's going on. That place where I'm stuck in my suffering. And I bring that forth. And whatever, and with good opportunity, you know, the right circumstances, the karma being right, something switches it. And I see, I can let it go.
Yeah.
It's all just fabrication.
Yeah.
And it's a beautiful day.
Well said.
Lovely narrative from of what happens to us all.
Yeah.
And I just want to add something to that narrative, that you're not actually the one who lets it go. It goes. And this is one of the things we start to realize. Things, when we sit still for long periods of time, everything comes and goes. And I keep loving the Lin Shi thing. I'm not getting the words exactly right. It was in one of the texts that we chanted. If it comes, don't hold on to it. If it goes, don't chase after it. So things are always coming and going. And you're creating the conditions. You can be in a bad mood and suffer till the cows come home. And then the cows come home. Did I make the cows come home? No, they...
I see them now.
Steve.
Yeah, so I'm one of these people who's more hyper-confrontational in this slap. What I really want to give a nod to is the commentator, this idea of like, what if, what if Chan just threw a snowball at him instead of responding later, and vice versa. I love the snowball as a form of a slap, because clearly a slap is something that's real and is a metaphor for things. And a snowball for me I tend to maybe, I'm quick to judge slappability or something. Snowball mentality. And I love the lay part. I'm a lay professional in a religious institution, and I really appreciate the Kante. It's that in the Zen community, it's mostly lay practitioners that very know for the because I'm a lay professional in a clerical world.
Yeah.
Thank you, Steve. And, you know, this is making me quite conscious of the fact that we really talked a lot about the slaps, but we didn't talk about the alternate of the snowball in the face. Mm-hmm. You know, and yet I think when we read that Jouet d'eau comment, when we hear that comment, we know that the rightness of it. And so I don't mean to start a whole discussion now about what it's like to get the snowball in the face, but I'm thanking you for bringing it up for me to, you know, just sit with later. Mm-hmm. Should we do another comment?
Yeah, one more.
If it's all right, I'd like to play devil's advocate a little bit here for the kid. And, you know, I'm not sure necessarily what he was saying at first was confrontational. I mean, I guess it was a little bit like, you know, I think when you first read it, he said, where is it that they don't fall, right?
Where do they fall?
Where do they fall?
Yeah, where do they fall?
Gotcha. So, I mean, yeah, I mean, he's given him a little bit of a ribbing, but I don't know if it was necessarily like, you know, let's devolve this into slapping. I think maybe he was actually being curious at some level. Yeah. Maybe Peng was, you know, he's a lay teacher, so he feels like, oh great, another monk giving me crap. And so he just devolves straight into violence. But maybe this kid was like, you know, where do they fall? Well, something we can't tell with the text, right?
Yeah, and in these koans, we're dreaming in. So lovely to turn it, like, because we don't know, and then we dream in. So what if he was really sincere? You know, what if he was coming from his deep practice, and this was his sincere question.
I'm like, you know, hey, where does it fall?
And what if Layman Pong's response was his sincere, loving answer? not irritated at all, but really responding to that great heart that we can imagine in this one who asked the question. It's a wonderful point.
Yeah, I agree with everything you just said. I was going to say almost word for word the same thing. In our group koan practice, we play with all these things, right? When you're working with this koan with a teacher, the instruction is, you know, this goes back to what Mike was saying, to see the sincerity of every person. Because these people wouldn't just be, you know, I don't know, I'm going to hang out for a couple of hours at a monastery. I don't think of them as college students, interestingly, because when I taught, I had all adults. So I think of them as people of all ages, you know, from 15 to 95, maybe a little older. But anybody who's a character in a koan, especially someone with a name, that's always a clue. There's a historian of Zen who says the more detail there is, the more likely it is that it didn't happen. But the more you want to pay attention to the details. Mm. So this guy has his name. What is it? Chuan.
Okay.
Yeah. So they're having a Dharma dialogue just like we are right now. And so you're called upon in traditional koan practice to be that guy and as sincerely, that's where you, sincerely as possible. And also to be Layman Pong as seriously as possible. And I do think this compassionate slap, what if that was the answer to the question, you know?
Like right here.
Yeah. Except, you know, like,
a little more violent.
And by the way, have you ever been hit in the face by a snowball?
Yeah.
Oh my God, it really hurts. It's like,
but it's the best answer to where did they fall?
Yeah. It's very generous.
I was working on this koan with my first teacher years and years and years ago, and it was snowing, so it was really fortuitous, and it was during a rest period. And I was going out to play in the snow, and he was coming in from playing in the snow, I think. I don't know what he was doing. But he looked at me, there's no one in the entryway, and he said, Melissa, where is the snow right now? Where is it? That was the only response in that moment. And we just laughed, and then we calmed down and went back inside. You weren't supposed to be doing that. But, so you know, be on the alert. We might ask you every moment, is the koan.
So then what was the second slap they got for? At that point they had sort of...
Yeah, we won't answer that question right now, but I think the questioning about it is to wonder into it, you know? Just like really, why do you keep going? What's going on with this? So lovely. These people, these fictional creations of the same practice that we're doing right now, this moment, all the different aspects of ourselves.
So let's sit for another breath or two.